Chevy gets a new marketing manager. Chery steals a top designer from Porsche. And when's the number 13 a lucky number? When it's the Mopar 13.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 185 for March 1st, 2013. Mr. Mopar pays a visit. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. I want to thank everybody joining us for Autoline After Hours. My co-pilot, who's normally here, Peter DeLorenzo, is not here. But we got Scott Burgess from Motor Trend and Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine. And
John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, you didn't bring any burgers this time, man.
No, I'm on a diet.
It shows. You're looking good.
Thank you.
It's there.
We got the skinny lens on me now, so.
Gary, last time you were here, you just driven the diesel version of the Jeep Grand Cherokee. You couldn't talk about it. It was all under embargo, but that was
embargo's
last
over,
time.
That's
yeah,
right.
So talk about this thing. What'd you think?
Well, I'll tell you, it is surprising to me that it has taken as long as it has for a diesel to make it in a vehicle like the Grand Cherokee. I mean, that fits so well. You know, the proverbial hand in glove makes all the sense in the world. You know, when you're rock climbing, you want torque. What better than a diesel to produce the torque? You want fuel efficiency in your heavy vehicle, provides fuel efficiency. I mean, I seriously think that if somebody is thinking about buying the V8 or buying the six-cylinder diesel, I'd buy the diesel in a heartbeat. I mean, it is so well done. It just fits perfectly.
How much more are they charging for that?
I'm trying to remember, it was like a $3,000 delta.
So a little pricey, but not too
hard. Not for that car. I mean, yeah. It's just horses for courses, right?
Right. And you drove the SRT8 version of it too, and you're still saying you preferred the diesel over that.
Well, no, because it's a different V8 that's available in the Grand Cherokee from the Grand Cherokee SRT. Okay, so it's a different Hemi that's in the SRT8, and that is just nosebleed fast. I mean, and the suspension settings on that are also very well done. And you know, it's sort of interesting in that SRT, they have a launch button that's down by the shifter.
No kidding.
So it has like a Christmas tree, you know, the old drag strip. You know, it goes down and just so. It just launches you when you get after it. So, yeah, just good fun. And you know, it's once again, it's one of these vehicles that I think Chrysler has to get a lot of credit for, of saying, okay, it's a mid-cycle refresh, but we're gonna put more into it. I mean, we're gonna put a lot more into it.
And because a mid-cycle refresh that's what, only two and a half years
right.
into the vehicle. I find that fascinating.
You know, because if you think about it, I mean, the Ram truck, which got the North American Truck of the Year, I mean, that was a mid-cycle. It wasn't completely a new
vehicle. Did you say Motor Trend Truck of the Year?
North America, right. Well, actually, I thought it started out as a mid-cycle refresh, and then they just kept on going and going
right.
and going. It was essentially an all-new design.
Right.
Car makers have given up on that traditional pattern of five-year cycle for a car, seven-year cycle for a pickup, or if you got new stuff, you got to put it in the next car that comes out. And I think that's the expectation, that nobody wants to buy a 13 model and it be just like the 12 model. It's got to be new. And, you know, and especially with technology, the speed in which that stuff changes as well. You just keep...
Hey, man, before it's over, we'll be back to the annual styling change.
Can't wait.
That might be a slight exaggeration because, I mean, tooling costs are still tooling costs, and that becomes...
No, they're gonna print them. Eventually,
there you go. That's right. 3D
printer. Yeah, good luck with that. I was the editor of one of those magazines that covered the 3D printing for a couple of years, and trust me, there's a long way to go.
There's a long way to go. That's right. That is. Hey, what'd you guys make of Chevy getting, or I should say General Motors getting Tim Mahoney, who had been at Subaru and Porsche, but has most recently been at Volkswagen, and boom, now they just pulled him in to do Chevy globally.
I think it's a great move. I really like Tim. I like a lot of the work that he's kind of led with, and Volkswagen has always been kind of known for a different take on a lot of their commercials, but also they've been growing a lot. I mean, they have that master plan to run the world in 2018, but
Well on their way.
And, you know, and Joel Uwanek, I think, did a good job at the beginning and then kind of got himself in trouble with Manchester United and all of those other problems. And so he's gone and they bring in Tim, and I think that he's going to do great.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important that as they are taking Chevrolet global, they take someone who worked for a global company like Volkswagen. And the other thing is that if you look at how Volkswagen has performed in the U.S. market of late, I mean, because that's always been, you know, the exceedingly soft spot for that company. And, you know, with particularly the Passat, I mean, that they're gaining share, they're gaining more customers than they had before. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way the marketing positioned vehicles and thought about this and what they're going to do. So I think it's important on a global basis, perhaps more than just the U.S. basis.
Yeah, I think it's a good move in the sense that here's a guy who's worked for a Japanese company. Here's a guy who's worked for a couple of German companies. So I think he understands the mindset of those customers, and not so much in the Porsche end of it, but, you know, Chevrolet's got to go after people who are buying Japanese and German cars right now if it really wants to grow. So
yeah, there's
it's good bringing him in.
There's growth potential, certainly in Europe a lot. And you know, all throughout Asia, I think that there's a lot of potential. So you're right. Having that kind of experience, Porsche experience, I don't know how much that helps.
Well, Chevrolet per se. But I'm just saying, you know, here's a guy who's used to dealing with, or how you get inside the head of high-end customers. I mean, with Corvette, there's something that will play off on. And just having the experience at a different car company, you know, in this case now he's got several car companies under his belt. I think it's a good move for them.
Well, and I mean, if we just look perhaps closer to home, and we look at Farley at Ford, you know, it's been a good thing for Ford that they got him from Toyota, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think perhaps, you know, injecting some non-common blood into your organization may have significant benefit in the long run. But I think, you know, he's going to have a real problem in Europe, though, because, I mean, that whole thing between, you know, what's an Opel and what's a Chevy, how do you differentiate between that?
If I were him, I would pretend Opel does not even exist. Seriously. I mean, he's got to stay focused on Chevrolet, and if he starts making accommodations to say, well, Chevy shouldn't do this because of Opel that, forget it.
I wonder if GM wishes that Opel did not exist.
They wish that it was turned around and making money.
Yeah, they certainly do.
Yeah, they're supposed to have a new labor agreement, I think, this week with Opel.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, that whole place is in a world of hurt.
Big time hurt. You know, and speaking of people jumping companies, I was very intrigued by this move of Chery, the Chinese company, hiring a designer away from Porsche. And I know I'm going to butcher his name, but it looks like it's Hakan Sarakoglu. And, you know, when you look at how Peter Schreier, who was hired away from Audi, turned Kia's look around. In fact, they liked so much what he did, they made him a president of both Hyundai Kia in charge of the group design. I think, you know, one of the things that we've noticed of the Chinese is that they're very good at copying. They're not necessarily good at creating great stuff from scratch. And I got to believe Chery said, hey, look at what Schreier did for Kia. Let's us go get some hot designer and bring him in here.
But don't forget, I mean, in the case of Kia, I mean, there, you know, he had some good bones to work with. Okay, so you know, the fundamental product was there. The styling wasn't there, but, you know, you had something to work with. So the question becomes that, okay, if you have the greatest designers in the world working on your product and your product is subpar, is that going to make it for you? And you know, you might make the argument. I mean, look at Peter Horbury, who is working for Geely, and Peter is certainly one of the preeminent designers, automotive designers in the world. And I mean, have we seen anything from them? So,
well, is he doing anything for Geely? It looks to me like he's only doing Volvo.
I thought that they moved him, and he was okay. He was concentrating more on that.
Well, if that's happened, it's probably relatively recent. The last year or so, it's going to take 3 years for something to show up in production. So maybe we haven't seen it yet.
So it's a really good move on paper, you know.
Correct.
And,
right.
And so we'll see what happens. I mean, 10 years ago, Hyundai was a company that was just kind of doing bad knockoffs of a lot of other cars. Mm-hmm. And it's taken them a while to really, I mean, once they started doing a lot of their original stuff, I think it's fantastic. And to Gary's point, it had good bones, you know. The platforms were solid. That, you know, the performance was good, and so you can make that step, and we'll see. I think it's a smart idea, and we'll see if they can turn around good vehicles too.
Boy, yeah, and goodness knows they have the money to be able to afford to hire probably anybody they want. I mean, let's face it. I mean,
because Chinese cars still haven't come to the U.S. And it's not because they don't want to come here. It's because those cars can't drive on our roads. They can't pass the tests that they need to pass. And
yeah, emissions and safety, they're not there yet. They'll be here. But, you know, what I was going to point out, boy, has it been successful for Hyundai Kia. I did our rankings this week on Autoline Daily looking at total vehicle sales of the top 7 car companies in the world and how much revenue they brought in and what their net profit is. And I was stunned to see, I didn't realize this, the Hyundai Kia group is now outselling the Ford Motor Company on a global basis.
Yeah.
And even though they bring in far less revenue than anybody else, by a wide margin too, their profit margin, corporate profit margin, is the best in the industry right now. I'm not counting Porsche or BMW. I'm talking for mass market, you know, high production, top 7 car companies. Their profit margins are the highest.
So I wonder, though, how much of that is predicated on what is essentially vertical integration that they have? I mean, because, you know, within the Hyundai group, you know, you have electronics manufacturer, you have steel manufacturer, you have shipping.
And, well, when I'm talking group, I'm talking automotive group.
Right, no, but what I'm saying is that, okay, if they happen to be your partner companies, you know, I'm thinking they probably get a pretty good deal on the steel.
They do.
And you know, they probably get a pretty good deal on the electronics that they use in their vehicles and so on. And therefore, you know, the profitability, you know, it could be reflected there.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think their costs are low. And their higher level of vertical integration than many companies have, that helps drop more money to the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean,
no question about it.
I can't think of any car company that's anything near it.
Yeah. The other thing I was shocked by, too, that stood out is Toyota now brings in twice as much revenue every year as the Ford Motor Company. And that was a shocker to me.
Wow.
I had no idea. Because when you look at the sales, Toyota is number one. Toyota is number one no matter how you want to measure it. Sales, revenue, profit, operating profit, it doesn't matter. They're number one right now. But Hyundai Group's coming up the list really fast.
And VW may be number two.
VW is number two.
You know, because I know that when that first came out, there was a little bit of, is it VW or is it GM?
Right.
And Toyota had them by 500,000 vehicles, total volume. And Toyota could be at 10 million vehicles globally
this year. And think about it. They're fighting with one hand tied behind their back because of the boycott of the Chinese consumers. Mm-hmm. So they're not even doing as well as they should be doing in China right now. And I think if they were, they might be at 10 million already, if not for that.
Well, it's sort of interesting. I just happened to have the statistics in terms of automotive production in Japan from the Japan automobile dealers or manufacturers. And automobile production in January in Japan was down 9.9%. So, you know, even with their production being down in Japan, you know, for Toyota to be in that position is fairly phenomenal.
Right. Well, I'd like to see the comparison of Toyota year to year. It may not be down that much.
Right.
Because, you know, Nissan's bailing out of Japan as fast as it can. Honda's moving a lot of production out of Japan, too. So it may not be that Toyota's down at all, even. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I was astonished to see how it just dominates the top of the list. But to your point, Scott, you're right. Volkswagen, they're a monster. They're just getting going.
And again, I mean, if you look at it, they have the wherewithal to spread their costs across so many different brands. And so, you know, those engineering costs are rather expensive for any vehicle development. And so being able to use it over and over again, and that gets to the point of the Hyundai-Kia thing, because, you know, you have the situation where Hyundai comes out with one car, and then the following year there's another version of that car, which is fundamentally the same engineering that was on the Hyundai. So yeah, that's a big advantage.
Well, I always keep thinking that in the U.S. market that Hyundai and Kia are going to butt heads price-wise. That you know, in my head, I see Kia as the cheaper brand. And so you get into a $34,000 Sportage, and you're like, man, this is a lot of money for that. But Hyundai's been able to move up as well. So every time I think they're wrong...
They've proved us wrong so far.
Yeah.
But I still believe that at some point they're going to grow to the point where they're really stepping on each other's toes. For now, I don't think it matters at all. It's just amazing, especially to see how fast Kia has turned its image around.
That Soul just keeps selling and selling and selling. And, you know, it's a technically, what, a subcompact or a compact?
It's a compact.
And they do 13,000 units, 10,000 units in a month.
And, you know, we had Michael Sprague from Kia on here about a month ago or something like that. And I hope I'm quoting this right. 40% of the car-buying public doesn't even know that Kia exists. I'm talking about the American market now. 40% of car buyers, I'm not talking the general population, of car buyers don't even know that there's a Kia out there that they might want to buy. So as good as they've done, that tells me there's a lot more upside growth for them.
I have a hard time believing 40% of the population hasn't seen those hamster commercials. I mean, that's just inconceivable to me.
Well, they don't know that those are for cars. No. Yeah. They just, I want to get a hamster.
Yeah, right. Hey, why don't we take a quick commercial break, and why don't we get Pietro Gorlier on here, and let's talk some Mopar stuff. But Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Pietro Gorlier, thanks so much for coming on Auto Line After Hours. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Johnny. Always a pleasure.
And we've got a Mopar 13 in the studio with us here. So maybe that's where we should start in talking with you. What's the Mopar 13?
Well, obviously, it's a sibling of the Mopar 10, the Mopar 11, the Mopar 12. We, as you know, in 2010, we launched this limited edition of Mopar vehicles. So after the Challenger, the Charger, and the 300, 2013 is the year of the Dart. I think is also interesting because it's the first time that we start working on a car just less than 1 year after the launch of the car itself. And there are a couple of interesting things of this on these cars. This car related to the fact that not only we have been working on the performance, the handling of the car, but also on the electronic. We have been expanding in the last few years all our accessories in the electronic field. We were the first one to launch the Wi-Fi hotspot. We launched the electronic vehicle tracking system. This is actually the first car from production with a wireless smartphone charger in the console bin. And that is something that obviously we will launch also in other vehicles as an accessory. And I think it's interesting because it's trying to give touch a new type of customer base. People that want to have a car, a performance car, a Mopar, but also interested in some technology and some innovation inside the car itself.
How does that work with your customers? Because my impression of Mopar customers is these are people who are into muscle cars big time. And when you start talking Wi-Fi hotspots and wireless charging, how does that go over with them?
Well, we need to start to the point that at Mopar we have 70 million customers. I mean, if you come, Mopar has become in 2012, big year for us, the 75th anniversary. Mopar has become the brand for the complete full after sales experience for both Chrysler and Fiat. And together we have 70 million customers around the globe. And so when you think about this number, you understand that there is a lot more than the typical DNA or more original DNA or more, but it is still very important that we keep on protecting with cars like this. But we have new customers and they ask for something new or something more, I would say, more than new. So the electronic vehicle tracking system I was mentioning, this GPS system that allows you to define a perimeter and maximum speed and getting a text message if you speed. And I'm used to say very popular with parents, a bit less with teenagers, has quickly become our second best-selling accessory.
Really?
Yeah, in the last...
Okay, so you have a car that looks fast and sinister like this,
yeah.
And you have this sending mom or dad a text message when Johnny goes too fast. Yeah. I mean, isn't that car...
We didn't put the EVT.
Oh, it's not in there? Okay, good. That's good.
But we can. I think it's really part of the evolution of the customer base, the way in which you tune a car, obviously not only engine, this car has a different different tuning of the steering gear. So it's really different ways to touch a car. And we see a very good response so far. So this is why we are investing a lot of in this innovation.
When people see the Mopar edition, what do you want them to walk away with? Is it a brand of vehicles? Is it the aftermarket? Is it the potential for what a vehicle can become?
Well, first of all, we want to excite these customers with something that is unique. I was driving here. I drive a heavily accessorized and tuned Durango. And I have a Mopar badge on the fender. And I crossed by a Mopar 11, the Charger. And we were at a traffic light. The guys gave me a thumbs up, thinking like, oh, I mean, that is part of the family, right? And I think the idea is that to give something unique. So this is why when we build these cars, we not only build the car, but we give also the owner's experience. Every car is coming with an owner's kit, with the story of that particular car, a metal Maroni plaque. There is an original design of sketch of the designer. So there is kind of being part of a family. We have now 3,000 drivers that are into one of our cars. No question for us is also a way of display what you can do. So you're spot on that. We launch every new car has a minimum of 100-120 accessories out of the gate when we launch the car. This car came out with 150 accessories the day in which it was launched, making the car the most accessorizable compact car in the market. So it's a way of showcasing what we have available.
So when you say 150, you meant four darts general, not
this one specifically. Right. So, and then obviously, once you have such a gamut of accessories, you can start quickly thinking about a special limited edition. That what we have done with the dart. I mean, the process of building these special editions has evolved. You know, the first one came out as an idea in 2010. I think I mentioned in this at Autoline that when I arrived at Mopar, they were afraid that we were going to screw up the DNA and the heritage. You know? And above all, I mean, okay, now we have an Italian coming and leading. So they gave me this bunch of books to read, and there was all these Mopars. And I said, yeah, but none of these cars of these cars came out from the plant with a Mopar badge. So then when we did the Mopar 10, you know, that was a quick deal with Ralph Gill, say, okay, let's build a Mopar, a real Mopar coming out from the plant with a Mopar badge. And I mean, we have been, I think, successful in showcasing what we can do.
Will we ever see a Mopar 500?
That is a very good question.
Pietro says yes. The boss says not so fast.
No, I mean, we did that. Let me put it in this way. The Fiat 500 has its own DNA, and there is already Abarth that is interpreting the performance part of Fiat. But we have the competence and the expertise to support the evolution of the customization of Fiat. This is why we have just opened, I mean, actually 1 week ago, a Fiat custom shop nearby the plant down in Mexico, where the Fiat 500 is built for the North American market, where we offer customization right there at the plant. So dealers can order cars or fully customized, and they come out from that custom.
And that's covered in a warranty.
It is covered in the Maroni sticker. So, I mean, we did you have graphic, you have interior packages, and we will develop other kits for that custom shop. So, yes, but we let Fiat having the space that it deserves in the market. And to be fair, we had cases where we did some Fiat interpretation with a lot of Mopar look, and we get from the traditional Fiat customers some kind of yes, I want a customization, but maybe I want Fiat customization.
But as you further develop and evolve Mopar, and you were saying that there's a lot of electronics products that you're developing and providing as accessories, is Mopar always going to be racing oriented, or is it possible that you could have a Mopar vehicle that would just be chock full of technology, that would not be black and have black wheels, but would be
rainbows.
Something rainbow, whatever.
No,
I mean,
I don't know whether rainbows, but no doubt. I think I mean, the brand is evolving. As I said, now today we cover already 10 different brands. We support 10 different brands. I mean, Jeep, Chrysler, Dodge, Ram, SRT, Fiat, Lancia, Alfa, Abarth, and Fiat Professional. So when you look at the new packaging of our parts, there are 10 brands. And there are a lot of implications based on the overlapping of platforms, the support of the dealers, the diagnosis of vehicles where we need to have integration. But also interpreting different brands, we get different needs. And so different needs mean mean also different type of evolution of what customization is. So by the way, if you think that we have already done a number of minivans completely technologically loaded with all these things, we have already done that in some way. And the problem is that when you do on a Chrysler vehicle, it's common, it's not a surprise. When you do on a vehicle like Fiat 500, there is kind of different perception maybe at the beginning, but we had a very good response. And motorsports racing will always remain as one of our core principles, because it's where we develop technology, where we work on the engines, where we, in some way also, we keep a link with our history and our DNA.
Pietro, you know, I've been listening to automakers for two decades now say we've got to get to build simplification in our assembly plants. We've got to minimize all this variation. That'll enhance quality. It'll get our costs down. We run these things at high first time through quality. And now you come and say, hey, we got 150 different accessories for this car. Your manufacturing people, how do you work this out? I got to believe they're pulling their hair out.
First of all, this is another very good question. First of all, we offer these, the most of these accessories through our dealer network. So that's the way in which you customize the car according to the need of the customer that is coming, is starting from a base model or whatever it's been ordered. And then there is this offer, this wide gamut of accessories where you can really make the customization. And that is very important, above all in the U.S., where most of the cars are bought from the lot. So you cannot really order everything in production because you want to drive out from the lot with a car. So it's absolutely important to have these accessories available at the dealership so that the car can be customized. That's the first point, taking out some of that complexity from the plant. Secondly, what we have done, as I was referring to the Fiat Custom Shop, we have these upfit centers that are at the end of the production line, and so the car can go through production in a more standard way, and then we can have these operations that are more flexible and can create packages and delivering a car customized without taking the complexity in the production, in the assembly line. And that has been one of our tools to significantly increase our accessory business.
Have you seen the change in customers where they're walking into dealerships now with a printout saying, please build me this car and I want all of these Mopar accessories?
Absolutely.
As opposed to, well, I really want most of those, but and I wish that were blue, but I'll go ahead and buy the Mopar.
There is no doubt that I would say 80% of the customer, I think their perfect number is 82% of the customer are walking into a dealership with some kind of printout from the website. This is why it is very important to maintain consistency between what they find into a website and what they find into the dealership. That is complicated because, you know, you start with all these colors, all these versions, and then, they walk into the dealership with the expectation to find the vehicle. So definitely, but the other element that is absolutely determinant to sell accessories to have the car with the accessory displayed in the showroom. That is the key element of the business of accessories. Dealers, we have dealers that are so good in displaying accessory that they add up to more than $1,000 of accessories for every car that they sell.
And I bet you that's good profit for them, too.
Absolutely.
Because they can install stuff,
load the service department with work it's the perfect, but it's a very, selling accessories a complicated deal because it implies a cooperation between the sales manager, the service manager, and the parts manager.
And the finance manager too, right?
Obviously, because you want to put them into the financing. So is I think in 2009, 2008, during the crisis, dealers started looking at every possible source of profit, and there are accessories. Actually, we can do something. Now, the problem is to maintain the focus while the industry is growing.
It's like a Mopar undercoating.
What's interesting to me is if we were to go to the Chevy dealer over there, that we'd go in and there would be accessories. Yet, if you look at Chevrolet or you look at Toyota or you look at Ford, there's no real distinctive brand anymore the same way there is for Mopar. And so how did you guys decide that you were going to carve that out and maintain that rather than just saying, well, you know what, it's going to be Chrysler accessories or Jeep certified accessories or Dodge?
First of all, you have just described a potential additional complexity. So the fact that you manage a variety of brands. And if you want to be, if you want to brand everything with the brand, you create complexity in everything you do. I was mentioning something very simple, like the packaging. If you want to, and if you go beyond accessories also to the component inside the car, obviously there are products belonging to different brands sharing filters, belts, and other items. So the good question is that if we didn't have Mopar, would have we created one? And I don't have that answer, but there is no doubt that we were so lucky to have the brand. And the brand was already well established and absolutely common, I mean, as a reference for both Jeeps, Chrysler, etc. We have a multi-brand showroom. So having an umbrella that can cover all the brands, still developing items that are specific for every brand, because we don't, I mean, we have different groups working on different type of cars. I mean, we just launched last year the Mopar Off-Road division, that is a part of our engineering organization that is only devoted to off-road. So they've launched, together with Jeep, the Jeep Performance Parts portfolio. This is a portfolio part that are only for Jeeps. And they are only, I mean, thinking and living and breathing every day Jeep. So still we maintain this different, because I'm not going to show this stuff on a Jeep. But then when you go to the go-to-market, to all the service that you need to provide to the dealers, the advantage of having an umbrella that is Mopar has been very effective.
You mentioned the word engineers. So Mopar has engineers that are actually developing products versus just simply saying, okay, we're going to have some contract manufacturing and we're going to be...
Absolutely.
Pumping.
We have a group of engineers, actually. There is here Chris Novak that is the head of the Mopar engineering team. And we have expanded that group because it's part of our core competencies, developing and accessories, and also looking at what's happening in the marketplace. I mean, the accessory business, there is a lot of competition out there. When we think about Jeep, I mean, there are catalogs like this of parts for Jeep. But we are the only one that can develop parts for Jeep together with the Jeep engineering team. And we do at the very beginning of the development cycle of the car. And this is why we've been able to shorten the time to market of our accessories.
Do you want parts to get out to market before the competitors? I mean, SEMA always talks about $30 billion a year in business that all of those members do. Absolutely. And you can be taking some of that, eating some of that pie.
That's our mission.
And are you guys making money?
Yeah, it's our mission. And obviously there is a lot. I mean, it's not so simple, because obviously, I mean, during the design of a car, there are many changes. So you need always to adapt yourself. But that's the trick.
Now, are you guys profitable? Are you guys turning a profit at Mopar?
Oh, that's the question that I always get when I come to AutoLine.
All this great business you're doing?
And I'm used to say that if we were not profitable, probably I wouldn't have...
You're still there.
I'm still there. I wouldn't be here after 4 years.
I would imagine it has the potential of being the most profitable.
Well, I mean, there is no question that the aftermarket, that the after sales is a profitable business. It's also a very complicated business, so you can't under-evaluate the complexity of the logistic and the supply chain of the service of a car. Because from one end, definitely you have parts, you sell accessories, you sell components. But on the other end, we have a catalog of parts and accessories combined Fiat and Chrysler of 500,000 part numbers. So, and we need to take care of every one of these little kids, because we have 70 million cars on the road, and we have the obviously the duty of being ready every time there is a need of parts. The complexity in terms of the electronic inside cars, in terms of developing the diagnostic tools, developing tools is incredibly becoming more complex, not complicated. Last but not least, cars are becoming more reliable with longer maintenance intervals. So also the service visits are less than they were. That is a great news for the customers. Obviously, it means that you need to, if you want to make the same business, you need to retain more customers. So it's a there is definitely profit there, but there is also a lot of complexity to manage.
You mentioned you're the first, you believe, production car in the world with this wireless charger for smartphones. You talked about being, if not the first, one of the first with this Wi-Fi hotspot. Is Mopar kind of a technological leader for the rest of the Chrysler group of trying things out that might then go into mass production?
Well, we have a lot of things in our not only at Mopar but at Chrysler that are definitely technologically advanced. I mean, just today, if you look at the investment on the 9-speed transmission, the 8-speed transmission, so there is no doubt that when you look at our vehicles, they bring a lot of innovation. We have a particular role. We can play on things that are not yet mainstream, so they are not yet in the market. We can develop them as accessories, and eventually they flow into production. There is no doubt that a wireless charger will be in future probably a standard option for every car, as well as when we launched some years ago the Wi-Fi hotspot, it was kind of the industry first. Now it's something... I would say basic that you can have into a car. So, but we can we are agile and flexible, and we can try to have this shorten this time to market. And then some of the things that we have done. And one of our, moment where I'm really happy when I see some of our accessories that become part of a production vehicle, because maybe there is a refresh, a MCA. And they say, oh, let's take the wheel of Mopar for that new model that we are building. That is, means that we really hit the mark.
Are there any parts that you guys won't make, like Playboy mud flaps or gun racks for pickups? Or, I mean, those are all aftermarket parts, too.
Christmas trees that hang from your rearview mirror.
Yeah. Calvin peen on something. Yes. I mean, there's lots of potential.
Yeah, there is a lot of potential. It depends if there is a potential. I mean, that's what you mean with potential. I think that we are very much interested to develop everything that can be sold, provided that it is aligned with the DNA of the brand of the vehicle.
Is there stuff that you have that can go on non-Chrysler vehicles that could go on a RAM box for an F-150 or...
Not specifically the RAM box, obviously, because you need to change completely the side of the
need
truck.
RAM.
Yeah.
But for instance, I mean, the EVTS that we develop can be installed on other makes. And not to mention that 2 years ago, we launched this Magneti Marelli offered by Mopar product line that covers, it's not specifically accessories, more maintenance. And this product line of 3,000 products covers 85% of the cars on the road. So we offer actually to our dealers the opportunity to take care virtually of every car that can drive in. And that's part of our expansion and trying to expand the business to offset better quality and longer maintenance intervals.
Does Mopar have any resonance in other parts of the world? I mean, do people in Europe say, Mopar, I want to buy
Mopar
those?
Around.
Well, if some of you is coming to Geneva next week, the auto show, you will see Mopar displayed in the Fiat stand, in the Alfa Romeo stand, in the Lancia stand, as the customization and accessory side of the business. Another element. We have now about 300,000 Facebook followers. We launched the Facebook page about 12, 14 months ago. It's been a pretty successful. And 20% of these followers are from outside North America. So we have Mopar clubs in Finland, in Middle East, in Australia, in China. So there is a lot. Obviously, it's more the heritage side of Mopar, so it's more about performance. There is drag racing in Middle East, I mean, that I didn't know until I came here. But it's growing. We have launched our format, the Express Lane. So we have now in the U.S. Almost 800 dealers that are offering Express Lane, Express Service, Quick Service, to compete with all the independents that are around. And we have launched Express Lane dealerships and service facilities in Middle East, in Arabia, in Dubai, in Qatar. So there is an expansion that is significant, not at the level of the U.S.
Hey, what we ought to do right now is switch gears and let's get the viewers involved. We've got a lot of questions coming in here, some phone calls as well. Ben, let's get to rapid fire. Let it rip. Okay, we got a bunch of questions coming in from our viewers, as I mentioned. Rum and Coke wants to know, are any Mopar goodies used in factory SRT cars?
Yeah, we have an exchange of parts with XRT. For instance, both the Mopar 12, the 300, and the Charger had the same rear axle of the SRT. So we definitely exchange parts because we have a collaboration, above all in terms of engine calibration, with the SRT team. And moreover, we are developing specifically accessories with SRT. The Viper that has been just launched, there are 60 accessories ready for the Viper that have been developed jointly between the SRT team and the Mopar team.
Okay, we've got a question from Brian. He says, since the announcement of Mopar as a separate brand, I've been confused as to why. Is there really a need for an entire Mopar division?
Well, first of all, the Mopar division was there. It's not been. It's simply that it's been revamped after many years before 2009, in which it was no longer, I would say, a specific focus of Chrysler as a group. The reason why you need an organization is because we have 10 brands. I mean, this is a fact. I mean, the collaboration, the partnership between Chrysler and Fiat has put under the same umbrella 10 brands. So you need parts, you need accessories, you need service, you need customer care for these vehicles. Often these vehicles, they share the same showrooms, they share components, so it would be very inefficient not to have a single organization taking care of all these vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Ben, we got some phone calls coming in. Let's bring the first one in here.
Hi, this is Jeff Leischek from Albany, New York. My question for the panel this week is, Mark Lois has been very visible in the media lately, and I was wondering, do you think this is going to get him in trouble with Lieutenant Dan? Thanks.
One of you guys want to tackle that one?
I don't know. Maybe he's prepping for that job.
Well, you know, if you read Whitaker's book, he wanted to have Mark Royce as the CEO. I don't know. I think Mark's been in the news a lot lately because he was down at the Daytona 500. There was a lot of buzz going on with that. They unveiled the Chevy SS. Wasn't he the honorary pace car driver,
right,
and all that? My bet is that Ackerson is happy to see Mark Royce getting all kinds of publicity doing those kinds of things, because they clearly have got to start gaining market share this year.
Or they wanted to distract, because at the same time there was all that hubbub over trying to give Ackerson a raise to $11 million.
Right.
And so let's put Royce out there and look at the shiny stuff and overlook the government report that said, no, we shouldn't give them this much money.
Right. I think if it wasn't for the SS and it wasn't for Daytona, it would have just been another week for Mark Royce. I think that event
put him in the spotlight a lot.
I mean,
right. Gary, here's a good one for you. This comes in from PRMD. He says, I often hear laudatory statements for platform sharing, for efficient engineering regarding Hyundai and Volkswagen, but I also hear scoffing at badge engineering regarding Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Mercury, Lincoln. He asks, what's the difference? When some of those brands were eliminated, was engineering simplification, efficiency reduced also?
Well, I mean, I think there's a difference between badge engineering and platform sharing. I mean, it's two different things entirely. So if we're looking at platforms, we're basically looking at the underpinnings that go into making a vehicle, okay? And all of the sheet metal will be different. The, you know, you'll, the IPs will be different. I mean, there's a variety of different things, but you know, the fundamental components that make up the chassis structure of the vehicle can be shared. They can be stretched. They can be modified. They can be, you know, improved in some ways. So I think that if you're just basically are just adding some salt to the soup, you still have the same soup. That's badge engineering. If you're completely making a different dish, then you're talking about using the platform.
I think it's a good question, though. I think that the Detroit automakers have been criticized for doing the same sort of thing that others are doing. You don't agree?
No, I mean, because I mean, if you look at it, I mean, look at all of the vehicles that General Motors has made off the Epsilon platform in the last 10, 12 years, right? I mean, and they're vastly different cars, right? And I don't think anymore we're all going, hey, that's the same thing as the Malibu. I mean, it just doesn't happen anymore.
Not anymore. No, that's right. More of the badge engineering, when the only difference between, say, a Ford Explorer and a Mercury Mariner was the badge. There was no difference.
Yeah, I mean, it was just trim.
Right.
Well, the good badge engineering is the Opel coming over here as a Buick. That's nobody knows.
Because otherwise we wouldn't have that car.
We wouldn't have the Buick Regal.
Right.
And, you know, so that's a good use of it in the fact that they're not sold in the same market. But when they're sold, you know, they look the same and they have a slightly different front end. That's just bad badge engineering.
Right. Badge engineering was Plymouth, if it's word.
That's okay. That was before his time.
Yeah, I was going to say, but we want to try to bring it back to...
But there is no doubt that I think a key element is always preserving the DNA of the brand. I mean, you can work... Obviously, today, cars are becoming every day more complicated. Electronic is incredibly complex and incredibly vital in the economy and the quality and the efficient of the car. But then you need to go to the DNA of the brand. You can't just rebadge. You need to go to the DNA of the brand, and that is what I think is the distinction between just bad rebadging and sharing of platforms.
Right. So if you look at the Dart, I mean, it's the Alfa Giulietta. I mean, they're completely different cars. I mean, it's
heavily just... differently engineered. In fact, even though the basic platform started the same.
Right.
Yeah. So much between the two cars would never even fit on one another. Enough of platform and badge. Ben, let's get to the next phone call that we've got here.
Hi, this is Jonathan Brown out in Old Japan, New Jersey. Great show, wonderful guests. I have a question with regards to SRT and Mopar Racing. I think I understand it, but I'd like to hear your explanation as to how those two, SRT and Mopar, are differentiated. I appreciate it. Look forward to your answer.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Much.
Great question.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, first of all, let's agree. With the exception of these limited editions, so there is one car per year in limited edition, Mopar is an after-sales brand. SRT is a production brand. So there is no confusion in terms of what is the mission of the two brands. We support everyone, including SRT, as an aftermarket brand. SRT is production and great production with I mean Viper and Grand Cherokee SRT and 300 and Charger and Challenger. We share technology, so obviously we have engineers that are working on tuning performance and motorsport, and then we have a simple division of the motorsport activities. We drag race, and that's our DNA. They do. Previously, I mean, they were supporting NASCAR. Today, there is the Petit Le Mans that is the big deal for 2013. So, but that is part of our, I mean, DNA. I mean, you couldn't see drag racing without Mopar. So, but there's a pretty clear distinction.
Ripituck twittered into us. He heard us talking about this Porsche designer going to Chery, and he says, "Have you ever driven a Chery? Can you claim them to be subpar?" I've never driven one. And we didn't say that they're subpar per se. What we said was they cannot meet U.S. emission or safety standards, or have not yet. And their styling really is not what the design community aspires to emulate or go to. So Cherry may actually be pretty good. They may be one of the best, if not the best, of the independent Chinese car companies. But there's no question they need a designer from Porsche. I don't think there's any question about that. Let's see here. What else do we have? Oh, George from Brooklyn wants to know, are you going to have anything special at the New York Auto Show for Mopar?
Oh, definitely. First of all, there will be still the Mopar 13 that we have displayed for the first time in Chicago. It's going to be there. But obviously, we will also support heavily the launch of the new Jeep Cherokee. And we have been working diligently on accessory customization and performance parts for that vehicle. So we will be there to support, as we support every new vehicle that we launch.
How many of those are available?
For the Dart, 150, I guess that's the number.
So a person, I mean, if
can
somebody...
Can go into a dealership and order.
Isn't that key, though, what you're saying, though, Pietro? You determine ahead of time we're going to build X numbers and then that's
You're talking about the Mopar 13. The Mopar 13 is 500. Sorry, I thought you were talking about the accessories for the Dart. No, it's 500 unit, limited edition.
So 500 and first guy comes in?
First in, first.
Sorry.
That's part of the idea of having a limited edition.
But isn't it also a way of protecting the brand?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we start to do bus models without any limit, you lose the reason to have that particular car.
You want it to be unique.
Unique serial number on every car. Owner's kit, that is part of the experience. We have a group of people in the field. They go and they deliver the owner's kit.
Have you guys seen these kits that they give the owner?
No, but they're very
cool.
It's very cool sounding.
It's very intelligent way of really building the brand.
It's kind of. I mean, and obviously we keep our relation with these customers, it has been a way to pay a tribute to the history of Mopar and coming out. And I found interesting, intriguing, the fact that after having had this great history in the 70s with the muscle car, you get to 2010, 2011, and you come out with the first car with a Mopar badge from the factory. So it's really, I mean, starting new the next 75 years of history.
Mm-hmm. Every car deserves a story, and you're giving a person the story of the car right when they buy it. And so I bet you the percentage of people that memorize everything that you give them from Mopar buyers is very high.
Because, you know, the point is that what we see, that customization is always one of the top five why buy for a customer looking for a car. So despite the fact that cars tend to be to have similar performances and obviously the style sometimes is going the same direction, etc. We see that you still want to have a car that is in some way expressing your personality. This is particularly true in markets like the U.S., where the car is really part of the family. I mean, Europe is slightly different. In Europe, you can live without a car. In the U.S., no. Aside the few metro area. So you grow up with the car that is part of the family. So you establish a different relation with your car. You call your car with a name. And so you want that car expressing in some way your personality, that or maybe that period of your life. So customization is still absolutely relevant in the process of buying a car. And this is why we work heavily in that.
We've got another question about, we were talking about racing earlier. Glenn E. wants to know, why did Mopar decide to leave the Torque Off-Road Series as a sponsor only after 2 years?
Yeah, well, first of all, we have more requests for racing than the one that we can match. Torque has been very successful for us, a partnership with Ram. we won everything. I mean, in 2 years, we participated in 6 competitions and we won 5 titles. So at the same time, last year, we won Pro Stock in HRA, Funny Car in an HRA. We won, obviously, NASCAR with Dodge, NASCAR Canada still with Dodge, and we even won the category of SCCA with the Fiat 500. So we actually celebrated a few weeks ago, and we had all these cars, et cetera. We had to choose some of the motorsport activities. Also with Le Mans that was coming in with the Viper. So we decided to stop the factory support, but we still work with the teams and the drivers. So some of the drivers will still drive our cars in other competitions. Mm-hmm. And I hope we will come back. It's been a very, very successful venue for us.
Hey, Ben, I think we got another phone call there. Let's bring that in.
George from Brooklyn. Question, front end 2014 Jeep Cherokee, WTF? All right, that's it. Let's go, Mitch.
The Cherokee? Is that what he said?
Yeah, the front end because you have the...
It's different.
Narrow.
Oh, here, Ben's got the graphic or the picture up.
Will there be a Mopar accessory to normalize that?
Well, why we don't meet in New York when the car will be shown for the first time? And it will be shown with all the possible variation and models, and probably I'm pretty sure there will be some different opinions. It's a polarizing style, as Ralph Gill.
Well, all you have to do is come up with a big brush guard that covers up the whole thing.
With plenty, if needed, plenty of accessories.
I don't think it looks that bad myself.
I don't either.
I think it's kind of cool that they're really going for a different look with the Jeep.
I love it. So I'm always obviously biased, but again, I think it's important to have the possibility to look at the car, to look at the performance, the capability of the car.
Headlight technology is rapidly changing as well, and so we're going to see more of these kinds of odd-looking things just because they look different, you know, with the addition of all these different kinds of LED lights that we're seeing come out, that you no longer need those big pieces out there. And so if we can get away with slits, hey.
That's what they'll go with.
Yeah.
Hey, the designers love the flexibility that these LED lights give them in creating graphics just with the shape of the light. I don't mean the shape of the headlamp. I mean the shape of the light. It's really interesting.
Well, look at the effect of the charger and, I mean, with the tail light. I mean, you see a charger from miles away. I think that is outstanding when in the darkness you can recognize a car from miles away. So I think it's definitely an important element.
I think the guys at Audi are probably kicking themselves that they didn't patent the use of LED lamps for running lights. That was a big mistake.
Well, hey, we're at the top of the hour here. We ought to wrap this up. But Pietro Gorlier, thanks so much for coming on. Really interesting what's going on at Mopar.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Scott Burgess, great having you back, as always. Next time, burgers, though, bro.
Yes. As soon as I lose 10% of my body weight, then I'll be back.
Okay, Gary Vasilis, great having you back again, too. And I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.